most young people are like trying to get like, I don't know, maybe the most optionality out of life or something, or like the most, I don't know, like make the most out of life, but they are really undersold almost on like the meaning in the mundane and in relationships and in parenting and in your marriage and in, you know, building something real. And I think they're tricked into thinking like it's your career, it's your status, it's how much money you make or something like that. And I would love to like, you know, help a subset of people realize like what real success is.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Girl Boss Interrupted. Today I had the honor and pleasure of speaking with Ashley Colby. Ashley is an environmental sociologist who studied at the University of Chicago and Washington State University in the department that founded the subdiscipline of regenerative agriculture. In her book, she explores subsistence food production and the myriad creative ways in which people are forming new social worlds in response to failing political, economic, and social systems. This will be an enjoyable podcast for listeners who are tuned into the homeschooling and homesteading movements, which I know many of you are. So, as always, do not forget to like, share, subscribe, and leave a comment on these episodes on any of the platforms where you access them. I thank you for your time and for your participation and for all of you who continue to reach out and share your, you know, brilliant observations and thoughts and suggestions with me. So continue to do that and continue to tune in, and I will see you again in 2 weeks.
Okay. So we have Ashley here. Ashley is a mother, founder of Rhizoma Field School, author of Subsistence Agriculture in the United States, and host of the Doomer Optimism podcast and Substack. So Ashley, welcome to Girl Boss Interrupted.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Ashley's work is so interesting and important and crucial, especially now that, especially now that food shortages are on everybody's mind. But in a general sense too, it's just, very timely, in a civilizational, like on the civilizational timeline, this is a good work. Yes. So anyway, I think that personal narrative often lends some real insight into people's work and its importance. And so I want to kind of open it up to you and have you start by introducing yourself and telling a bit of your story, how you got from point A to point B and what point A's and B are.
Okay. Sounds good. So yes, I'm Ashley Colby. I am, trained as an environmental sociologist, in the U.S. I'm from Chicago, grew up in a sort of working class household on the south side of the city. My dad is a firefighter. So kind of this, you know, working class labor unions type upbringing, really nice, pretty nice upbringing overall. And I guess the work that I do now is so different from my upbringing. So, I mean, I could like try to give a short version of like, my life story, but, my work now is basically in, maybe you could say something like finding regenerative ways of living. I mean, it's like, I focused a little bit on agriculture, but I also think like all of these things are interconnected: agriculture, how our relationships are, education, you know, basically all aspects of our society need to be, you know, reimagined or, you know, maybe reconstructed from the past, some of the things that we've let go traditionally. So, my story is more or less, I got a scholarship to the University of Chicago And that's why I was able to go there. They have a few scholarships for the children of Chicago policemen and Chicago firemen. And that really changed my trajectory in life. Like, it was a completely full scholarship. And so I was able to go to this school that's like really fancy and very much outside of my background. And that sort of set me on a trajectory to explore, more or less like, you know, what's out there in the world, what's different from my upbringing on the south side of Chicago. Like, you know, what different, you know, ways of life are there. After going to the University of Chicago, I kind of got, decided, I don't know what exactly forced me to make this decision. It was like a series of probably like books and movies, that I just decided I'm going to travel around the world. So I went to like 35 different countries. I worked babysitting as a nanny, for cash in Chicago. And then I would go on these like around the world trips. And that really cemented my interest in environmental issues and like food issues. You know, I just went to so many places around the world where there were these like, you know, beautiful little markets, you know, beautiful small farms, people living like, you know, kind of peaceful existence, you know. And that was so different from my upbringing in Chicago, which is just like in a city, you know, more or less you're in the rat race. Like, you have to be in the rat race. People expect that of you. Otherwise you know, you basically are considered not a success. And then that got me to do my PhD program, in environmental sociology. And then I focused on, people who produce food for their own consumption. So I was just asking them like, okay, so you live in a city, you live in Chicago. I talk to people in Chicago, like, well, why did you get into small scale, food production? What does it mean to you? And then my insights from that research were basically that I think we just need a lot more people doing a lot more hands-on work. And the people who got involved in this small scale food production in Chicago, you know, they started connecting with their neighbors. They started making informal economies. It sort of changed their relationship with their kids if they had kids, like, you know, showing them where food comes from and all of this. And it made me realize, like, I think we really just need a lot more of this experimentation in, like, whatever you want to call it, homesteading or just small scale production, even like home economics stuff, like, cheese making and, you know, yogurt making and canning things. It's like, it's really fun and it's really a cool thing to show your kids, and it's good for your family. And then, so then when I came to, I moved with my family to Uruguay to basically have an existence like that, which is a little easier to do here because it's more common here. And so, you know, we have a small homestead, and then my work is basically in, hosting American university students to come here and work alongside small scale producers. And then I talk about, you know, like the environmental implications of doing of small scale, you know, here in Uruguay, they call it agroecology. In the US they call it regenerative agriculture, but it's pretty much similar, you know, ways of producing that are environmentally friendly. And that work is really good too, because I really like hands-on education, experiential learning. Like, the students come and they're just like, they don't know what to expect, and then they have the best time, like, just getting their hands dirty, talking to the producers, asking them why they do the things that they do. The most important insight a lot of times when the students come here is that they see that the people who have small scale farms here can't make it work without their community. Like, a lot of times it's like their friends, their cousins, their neighbors come and they exchange things, they share tools, you know, they work together in ways that is essential to their success. And kids are around a lot, which is really fun. And, you know, so I think, so my work now is basically in trying to get more people to wrap their head around what small scale food production might look like, what alternative education might look like. And then finally, I'm also involved in, you know, just interested in and sort of going more deeply into alternative education now, like a homeschooling. When I bring American university students here, it's like alternative education. It's, you know, experiential learning, which is different from most things they have in college. And then, you know, I'm increasingly interested in, you know, homeschooling methods and or homeschooling cooperatives coming up, you know, just like different approaches to education than what we have now, especially in the US, as like it's your standard education. And you know, I'm interested in that across the board, basically K through, you know, graduate school. I think the way we approach education needs to change totally. So that's another thing I've been thinking a lot about, and starting to dip my toe in recently.
That point interests me, and I'd like to hear you say more about it. What do you think is the, you know, underlying fundamental philosophical or practical problem with the American education system?
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't think I would go so far as to say, like, a lot of people say, like, any kind of schooling where kids have to sit 8 hours a day or whatever is industrial in nature. I think there are better and worse versions of kids going to school and being in classrooms. That can look so different depending on the school and, like, what the school is like. And, you know, even, for example, a friend of mine just yesterday was tweeting about how, you know, his kid goes to a regular public school, but in that school they have, like, welding class and dance class and art, and they have, you know, just like a very wide variety of things that they teach, and it's not just, you know, standard education. So, you know, there's a lot of diversity in what I think could be a potentially positive education for kids. What I see that's really bad, that scares me a ton, is, you know, basically I, like, a lot of my critiques come down to a critique of transhumanism. And I think one of the things that's happening in schools is that there is a desire to measure everything and make all outcomes determined by standardized tests, for example, which then forces teachers to see students in terms of how they're measured and to teach to the measurement. So then it just becomes like this thing where there's no diversity, no understanding of differences in learning, you know, and like whoever is some bureaucrat who's making these tests is determining, like, basically the minds of all these children. Like, we're just teaching to the test. And then the other thing that really scares me is, yeah, we've got these teachers increasingly teaching to the tests, and then the kids are increasingly forced to sit still. There's not a lot of, you know, like, diversity of, you know, subject matter, and not a lot of time spent outdoors or in play. And then they, you know, they just medicate them. That scares me so much. Like, I mean, part of the reason we, like, left the U.S., there's multiple reasons, but one of the reasons was, like, I almost feel like it's putting your kid at risk to have them go, like, if we stayed in Chicago where we're from, like, to have them go to Chicago public school, I mean, it's almost like putting them at risk. Like, you would have to be, like, worried about them either getting medicated or, like, you know, just being so standardized to the point that they get anxiety, all this kind of thing. Basically those are the things that really scare me. And those are real trends that are, they're getting worse, it seems.
Yeah. I think that this, it's funny, this sort of homesteading and homeschooling, meme almost. It's become like an avatar for the new counterculture in so many ways. In fact, I use TikTok, I justify my use of TikTok by saying this is research. But there's like actually like a group of people who identify themselves on TikTok as like homeschooling, homesteading mamas, and like that. Mm. That's the whole thing. So yeah, do you perceive that? So you've just said that you think that these are growing problems in the American education system. Do you perceive that there is a growing opposition to these problems?
Yeah. So totally. I think homesteading and homeschooling, they're so aligned, and I think people are sort of waking up increasingly to just like. I think what I heard from people who send their kids to like regular school or public school in the U.S. is that during the pandemic, when they came home, either they had to come home to like just do remote virtual learning, or you know what, you know, whatever kind of setup they had to try to get through school during the pandemic. Parents were just made incredibly aware of like the quality of their kids' education in a way that they weren't before, the bad quality of it. I mean, they were just like, you know, I think a lot of people, and I don't want to be judgmental of people. I think a lot of people just like do what they're told, and they go get a job, and they, you know, they show up every day and they send their kids to school, and they do like the right thing, quote unquote. And they're not critically interrogating these systems. They just think like the, you know, I'm going to send my kid to school. I'm going to be normal. I'm going to do what everybody else does. And I think the pandemic really just like cracked that open for people. They were like, what? I had no idea what my kids were learning. Now I know, because I was like looking over their shoulders at virtual learning, like, you know, and increasingly the teachers and the administrations are like fighting with one another. It's just like this attitude of like compliance and authoritarianism, that kind of stuff. I think it is, and I think the homesteading part goes hand in hand with that, because I think a lot of people also realized during the pandemic, like, they came home, they spent time with their families, and a lot of people either, like, got divorced or were like, I need to spend more time with my family. They were like, this is, I mean, they're just, like, had this realization, like, what am I doing with my life? I'm spending, all like, so many hours away and not prioritizing, you know, the most important people in my life, and to me, like, all of those insights go hand in hand. It's like this revelation where you're just like, you know, the business as usual way of living life is just, it's fundamentally not as meaningful or fulfilling as like, as promised, I guess. And so then people are looking for this alternative, and the alternative, it's really hard to describe in words how it's different. And it's easy to make fun of, I think, for as an outsider, like, oh yeah, homesteading, keeping chickens, like, who cares, that's so stupid, or, you know, different ways of like minimizing it, or homeschooling, like, oh, you're just so fringe, you're so different, or your kids are not going to be socialized, they're going to be weird, or whatever. And I think it's, you know, it's not about, you know, any one set of practices. It's about an approach to life where you're like, you know, you have more autonomy, and you're thinking more critically about like what you want out of life, and you're co-creating life, like you're co-creating the life that you want to live. So when it comes to homesteading, for example, there's no like consumer product you can buy to like to get like a homestead in a box, like that there you have to make it. Like if you want to have chickens or a garden, you know, you have to intentionally make every choice. And you have to decide where to spend your time, and you have to be creative, and you have to think like, you know, is this something that I'm drawn to? And you need to try new things and get outside of your comfort zone. Same thing with homeschooling. It's like there is not really a homeschool in a box. Usually homeschooling, when you try to make it like formal school, or regular school, it doesn't really succeed at home like that. Or a lot of people get like, try it that way. They try to do like workbooks, like teachers at home. And then they're like, wait, this is not what I'm looking for. And homeschooling, I think also is like, you know, I want to show up in my own life. I want to make decisions about my own kids' education. I want to, you know, I want to be an active participant, not passive, not just receiving what like some government bureaucrat has decided are the standards for what my kid needs to learn, but instead like, you know, I think actively determining your own kid's future in education. So in some ways I think like, yeah, I think a lot of people are defecting, but the doomer optimism thing in my podcast, like I realize there's also a journey involved there. Like usually when people first defect, they are like, just so sad or upset or angry. Like why is life like this? This is, I'm doing everything right. And it's still, really difficult and or not as meaningful as they said it's going to be. You know, the whole idea of like, I'm just going to work and keep my head down, and then I'm going to retire, and that's when I'll finally like relax and enjoy life kind of thing. And it's like, you know, you're waiting to totally live your life. So when people realize, like, I think during the pandemic, for example, they were like, there's some fundamental mismatch between my goals in life and like how I'm going about things. It can be very disorienting, and so part of the Doomer Optimism Project is to kind of help people through that, to talk through people's experiences of, like, you know, having this realization and then trying to seek some alternative, and then just, you know, helping people to take some either first steps or next steps toward whatever it is, whether it's homesteading or homeschooling or, you know, considering a different kind of setup with their work so that they can be with their family more, a different approach to their marriage, a different approach to raising their kids, you know, all of those things. I think it's like, it's really overwhelming, though. It almost feels like you have to remake every part of your life. So when you, like, have these realizations that you're looking for some alternative. So yeah, we're like almost like a support group for that.
Yeah. That was actually one of my questions for you. And I know you have a post on the Substack sort of explaining the name Doomer Optimism, but just for the sake of the listeners, could you kind of get into that and you know, tell us what the Doomer meme actually is? And
yeah. Okay. So, it's so funny because Doomer Optimism was, like, I was just totally joking around with my friend Jason Snyder on Twitter and just, like, made up the term. But the Doomer meme is basically, like, this person who's, let's say, obsessed with reading all the most up-to-date climate literature. They're antinatalist. They're, like, against having kids. They just feel like there's almost no reason to live. Like, almost every day they're just talking about the different ways in which things are doomed. You know, whatever it is, pick your poison. They're just, like, you know, sort of, like, almost like pathologically obsessed with talking about how things are doomed and how bad things are, which I shouldn't laugh. Like, it is, it sucks. If you're stuck in that world and everyone around you is like that, it's horrible and it's very depressing. And there's a couple of groups online that are, like, filled with environmentalists, and they're just, like, you know, they're just, like, suicidal ideation, like, all this stuff. Like, how could I ever bring children into the world? Or I feel so much guilt for bringing children into the world, all this stuff. And it's, like, it's just no way to live. So I met Jason, and we were just sort of talking about our different homesteads and, or, you know, our different projects. And, you know, I'm like, you know, I understand the doomer perspective. There's plenty of things to be doomed about, but or to feel doomed about. But I'm optimistic despite that. Like, what else are you going to do? Are you just going to, like, sit at home and read, like, every next New York Times doomer article and just, like, right, be sad about it? Or are you going to, like, do, like, anything else?
Just, like, make into the abyss.
Yeah, I mean, just, like, doom scrolling. And, you know, there are things to be optimistic about. And so I said, yeah, Doomer Optimists Unite, you know, just, like, totally made that up. And then it just, like, caught on. People, like, resonated with the term. They were like, yeah, I feel the same way. Like, I feel, like, what else are you going to do? You have to just learn what, you know, the ways in which things are bad enough that you can, like, get around them and get away from them or make something better. And so Doomer Optimism has come to be, like, this umbrella term of different people who are sort of, like, you know, either remaking things or embracing tradition or, you know, finding different ways to exist in the world that are fundamentally more meaningful than just getting stuck in the doomer phase.
Yeah, totally. It's so easy too. It's easy, but it's such a trap to get sucked into the negativity, you know. I actually, Ezra Klein tweeted recently that one of the main questions that he gets when he does public appearances or whatever, you saw that, yeah, which was, you know, these people, these millennials, and I'm guessing Gen Z, just asking him, a stranger, whether it's ethical to have children or not. It's like, come, I mean, that to me is just such a demonstration of being in a mental prison.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, like, the doomer thing is, it's almost like signaling, it's like virtue signaling for a lot of people. Like, look at how informed I am about the state of the world, that I'm so informed that I'm aware that it's, like, unethical to have children. And it's just such a dead end, like, mentality. It's, like, literally just, like, I mean, if we're, like, gonna go Freudian, it's, like, a death drive. I mean, people are, like, they want an excuse to just, like, curl up in a hole and just, like, be sad their whole lives. And then, you know, there's, like, a lot of people who just are, like, I hate this. Like, I hate the news. And they're just, like, mad at the news and not realizing, like, you know, you get to choose where you put your attention. You don't have to just be up to date on all the most recent articles that tell you not to have kids. You know what I mean? But I think there's a lot of intense social pressure there. And especially, like, in liberal or well-educated circles, there's a strong social pressure to, like, be a doomer.
Yeah, totally. I definitely. I mean, I had children before anybody in my class, really, and have had a second one rather rapidly subsequently. And I feel I definitely feel the skepticism and sort of sense the peer judgment a little bit. Not that I care, but you know, there's definitely a meme. I don't know. So something has really grasped the heart of millennials, and it's the spirit of antinatalism.
It is. And I think not only antinatalism, like, putting off fertility forever and thinking that there's just, like, endless optionality in your fertility and like being psyoped into, like, being girl boss interrupted, like being a girl boss, like, you know, where your career is first. And there was this woman who, like, was on the cover of some magazine saying, like, you can freeze your eggs, you can have it all, you can freeze your eggs and you can be an executive and blah blah blah, and then all of her frozen eggs failed to fertilize.
Yeah.
And it was like, this woman is on the cover of a magazine advising all these young women who want to have a family, like, in my opinion, the most important and creative thing you can do in your life, most significant, most meaningful. And telling all these people, like, you can have it all. And then, like, literally herself failing to achieve that goal. Like, it's such a psyop. And I think it's so bad for, you know, like, women, but in families and young people in general. You know, I have a lot of peers. I'm 36. I have a lot of peers who have been married and have not yet had kids at 36, like, haven't even started. And I'm like,
and
so either they're
going
to just have one or none, or maybe they're trying right now. Or like other friends who, like, just had kids, you know, and they're starting to be late 30s. I was so lucky. In some ways, I'm lucky that I came up from a working class family, because I didn't get any of that, like, girl boss messaging. My parents were like, family's the most important thing. Having kids is great. When, like, my mom had kids at 26, she was like, 26 is a great age to have kids. Like, you're young enough to start, or you're old enough to, like, be mature and, you know, have had some adulthood years without being a parent, but young enough that you can, like, keep up with them. So I had my first at 27, and I was like, I think literally people of my, like, college cohort were like, oh my God, a child mother, a child bride.
Yeah, I know. I'm 26, and that is the reaction. That is the reaction.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So, and it's so crazy. Like, it's just crazy. I think, like, you know, I'm not so extreme or anything on, like, natalism in general, but I feel like there's just a happy medium. Like, and I think that if your explicit goal is to have a family, you need to consider your fertility. There is not, like, endless optionality. You have a limited time where you are fertile. And I think that's not a judgment on any women or a judgment on anyone who has had kids later in life. It's just, like, a biological fact that women should be told. And, you know, they just shouldn't be, like, psyoped into thinking, you know, that they have, you know, endless optionality, and then they get to a point where they're ready to have kids, according to when is the appropriate time, and then they're, you know, unable to. And it's like, this huge heartbreak.
It's heartbreaking. And then there's,
and then, or there's like millions of, you know, procedures, fertility procedures. And it's like, now it's like this crazy medicalized process and, you know, more transhumanism. And it's like, you know, we could have avoided this if we just acknowledge like our biological, you know, the biological bell curve is you're going to be most fertile in a period of time. And if you want to have more than one kid, if you want to have a family, you just need to consider that. And I also thought it was really nice having kids at 27, starting then, like a really nice age. I had enough time, like, hanging out as a young adult and like going to concerts and going to restaurants. Like, I got it. I get it. Like, I don't need to be an adolescent for like 2 decades before I have kids. Yeah. You know, like there are so many people I know who like don't want to give up their ability to go to restaurants and concerts and stuff. It's like, I mean, fundamentally there is something more meaningful in life than that. Not that you can't still go to a restaurant when you have kids, but you know, it's like, it is.
It's harder for sure. But I mean, gosh, it's the daily, I mean, not everybody should have kids, but in my experience, just the daily purpose, the daily, like the love, the little things. Our mutual friend Willow has described it as like standing over a grate as it's raining diamonds. I'm going to get like emotional when I'm thinking about this, but it's so true. Like, every day has like a little bit of beauty. I'm sorry. What the heck? I'm going to have to cut this out.
You just had a baby, Alan. My God. I know. And like, and it is, I can't believe that was Willow's tweet, because I was just talking to somebody on my podcast about that tweet. And he was like, I don't know where I read it and I can't find it again, but he mentioned that tweet. And I never, came across that. What so it was about, every day is raining.
Standing over the grate as it's raining. Exactly. You can only catch so many, but it's just, it's like, it's almost like this amazing beauty, this amazing gift from God is just, it almost becomes mundane, but it's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen.
Yes.
And I think,
no, I think what's crazy is that, like, probably most young people are like trying to get, like, I don't know, maybe the most optionality out of life or something, or like the most, I don't know, like make the most out of life, but they are really undersold almost on like the meaning in the mundane and in relationships and in parenting and in your marriage and in, you know, building something real. And I think they're tricked into thinking like it's your career, it's your status, it's how much money you make or something like that. And fundamentally, my critique is like of this like very instrumental view of life. Like you're only successful if you have like a giant house and you make a ton of money or you have prestige in your career. And I would love to like, you know, help a subset of people realize like what real success is. And real success is like this totally unmeasured beauty that you make on a daily basis. Like this meaning you make on a daily basis. Like there is nothing more important than like this work of like making the next generation of people. And it's like, it's so hard to describe to people how,
because like, you can't measure it. Yes, I agree completely. And I think, and I'm sorry, I just interrupted you, but I think the thing that sticks out to me about what you're talking about, you know, that people are confused and think it's status, career, which are all things that are sort of objectively measurable in a economical sort of way. And in a, like you can express through capital what that means, what status equals and a paycheck. And I think that there is so much about life that has become illegible to us because we cannot express it through the lens of like capital acquisition and really like love. You can't put a dollar sign on that, but that's what it is.
Yeah. Yep. And like, basically that's exactly the thread that runs through you know, like the homesteading and the homeschooling and like natalism and all of this stuff is like, I'm interested in bringing out into the light these kinds of experiences. And in many ways, you can almost not describe to people, like they almost have to experience it to understand it. You know, like why it's meaningful, why it's important. But like bring that out into the light, like this idea that there might be, I mean, almost it's like this whole hidden world that's like unbelievably exciting and beautiful. And you get a whole wide range of like emotions and the whole human experience. And it's like, I mean, when you peel back the curtain, like there's just so much more to life once you realize this, and then you get into it and it's like, I mean, it's really just, again, hard to describe, but it's like, you know, the most meaningful things. Like, I mean, people, for example, have a, you know, regular career and have a job, and then they like reserve any sort of like beauty or joy for like vacation, you know, like they go to some fancy place and they like have a vacation, and like it's like now is the time I get to like experience anything beautiful or enjoy life at all. And I just wonder whether or not it's possible to set your life up so that like every day you get this like, you know, ability to feel like a real sense of accomplishment, a real sense of joy, connection to your family, like, you know, something that was really formative for me was being a nanny. And when I was a nanny for a lot of wealthy families in Chicago, in my young adulthood. And I think it was formative in two ways. One, I like learned to love children and see them as real humans and humans worthy of like integration into society, not like to be separated out. And so that was really good as like before having kids to like learn how to love and relate to children, I think was really good for me. And I think probably something we need more of, just like, you know, young people being involved in the care of other younger people. But I also like realized that a lot of these wealthy families, the way that their life is set up is that both parents work from like 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. and they just almost never see their kids. And like they literally leave before they wake up, and then they get home and they go to bed like an hour later. And it's like that's success. If that's success, like I don't care. Like I don't care what I have to do to like be unsuccessful. I don't care what that does to my career or anything like that. I'm not doing that. Like, I'm not going to bring all these kids into the world and then you just never see them and like not be there for them. And they want their parents so badly. And they being a nanny, you just see the parents leave or, you know, or the parents come home. Like the kids are just want them. They want them so badly. They just need to be with them and they can't be. And it's just, heartbreaking, honestly. And so, for me, like seeing that really helped me to cement my plan, which was basically, I don't care. We basically did a, almost like a mini retirement, like during the period where our kids are under, let's just say 4, is when they need you the most. Like they just are obviously like so tiny, and especially when they're under 1, but you know, they're just, when they're so little, they really need you. So my husband and I like work part-time remotely and, you know, just make enough to get by. But we do that because we are now both able to be present in our kids' lives in their littlest ages. And then as they get a little older, then they want to be out of the house more. They have, my kids go to a little rural school, which is great. They have after school activities. Like they want to integrate into society more as they get older. But that period is the period where like almost everybody, if they can make it work, like if you can make it work, like get you, your kids need you when they're under like 4 or 5. And if you can get them set up with a life, like, get, you know, where you're with them, those like early childhood years, like it's just invaluable. And then those memories for you, like you'll never regret not like, you know, spending like, time you with know, your kids as opposed to like being in the office or making more money.
Yeah. I think, I think millennials and Gen X have some deep wounds with regard to their parents, the boomers, the sort of boomers and like early Gen X. I think there's really something there. There's something, some deep longing in these later generations for a love that was sort of robbed of them.
Yeah, yeah. And like, I think that probably millennials were the first generation where it was like super widespread daycare, you know, where it was like more commonly where kids are going to daycare, and then there's two parent households more and more starting with the millennials, I would say, as babies. And that wasn't even that widespread then. And now it's way more widespread. And it's just, you know, I think like the problem too, is that in these kind of scenarios, like fundamentally the person, the entity at fault is like the capitalist system that just makes all these people work and, you know, and then makes more money when kids are in daycare, than, you know, than it would having mothers at home or parents at home. Like, you know, for example, I think like Biden tweeted something like, you know, we need more early childhood care. So we're like gonna fund like daycares. It's like, as opposed to like finding ways to help mothers stay with their babies, you know, as a, like, why would the solution be daycares? You know, I think that's like the first thing people think is like, get everybody to work, get everybody separated, you know, get the mothers into the workplace, get the babies into like, you know, some sort of institution. And I see some pictures from daycares and it's like, you see these like under 1 year olds all in little high chairs at a table, like all together, like they're not in anybody's arms. You know, they're not touching anyone. Like, I can't imagine day in, day out, like the impact that that has on a person's psychology. And I think that there's probably some studies on it, but like, I think probably it's something that's probably pretty hard to study and or like disincentivized to study. But it just makes me like really freaked out. And I feel like extremely guilty when I see kids in daycare like that. Now, the other thing that I want to say, though, is like, I don't want to also be judgmental of women who are like forced into that situation. It's not their, you know, a lot of times it's not their fault, especially working class women, that they like have to put their kids in daycare, that otherwise they can't make rent, they can't like survive. And so then it's just this vicious cycle where it's like, I'm not blaming the women, but I feel like this whole system's really screwed up and like very bad for everybody involved.
Yeah, totally. That was sort of a big motivation for starting this podcast and thinking about that, because this whole like women in the workplace thing it's not the problem isn't that women have things to offer society and good things to offer society and that women are productive. That's not the issue. The issue is the way that success has been coded as in a very particular way that is divorced from family, does not account for children, does not account for the just domestic sphere whatsoever.
Right.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think it hurts working class women more than anyone who often, I think, would be the most motivated to stay home with their kids because they're not as enchanted by the girl boss archetype as, say, like an upper middle class undergrad.
yes, totally. And it actually is something that's pretty fundamental to stuff I've been thinking about a lot. And I think a lot about like Louise Perry's work and Mary Harrington.
They're so good.
they're like, and I think fundamentally, like, this is a pro women argument. This is a pro-child, like, care for children in the way that they need argument, which is fundamentally, like, you know, if you think that there is no downside to, like, let's just say upper middle class women choosing to go to work for prestige, what happens when that choice is made is that there are all sorts of middle and working class women who have to pick up the tab for that. So they have to care for the kids. They have to clean the houses. And it just is this cascading thing where there is no, decision you get to make as, having a child and then going into the workplace that doesn't have consequences for working class women or babies, you know? And so it's like one of these things where, like, I don't know how this has gotten coded as like some sort of like fringe point of view, but it's like, you know, it's a pro-woman, pro-child point of view, to think, you know, any woman, who, you know, I would almost say it to the point of like, we should just have a supportive environment for mothers to be with their babies, and it should be encouraged culturally and like sociologically on any possible level, it should be encouraged. And it's the opposite now. It's discouraged, and it's so hard for people to make it work.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, that kind of dovetails with a question that I wanted to ask you, tying some of these threads together. So the topic of my work, the focus of much of my work is women and womanhood and motherhood and female friendship. Actually, that's the thing that I'm really interested in. And in fact, you and I have shared some girls' chats between us. But anyway, my question is, what does the work of regenerative agriculture have to do with women specifically? What's the specific implicit or explicit connection there?
Yeah, so, you know, I think I'm going to sound like a women's studies major or something talking like this, but like there is something, there is like, you know, maybe a different, I don't know what women's studies department would even say this nowadays, but like there is like fundamentally a rapacious nature of global capitalism. And let's just say the economic system as it is now, whatever you want to label it, because it's not necessarily like capitalism's fault, but it's industrial, exploitative, everything needs to be monetized and measured. Otherwise it's not worthwhile system that, fundamentally, I think like takes away everything that's like good and beautiful in the world. And so like, the way we do agriculture is this way. It's standardized, it's mechanized, it has to be measured, and it has to be good for industry. Even something as precious and sacred as food has become a commodity. More or less, most of food that's being grown is a commodity. It's treated like something that you could exchange on a commodities market, and measured in these different, different standardized practices. The same thing is true with, you know, women's issues. It's like more or less women need to fit into this industrial system. They have to, be economically worthwhile. Otherwise they're not, you know, contributing in the correct way. And everything that's like good and sacred about motherhood and womanhood, gets downplayed, and everything that's like, able to be measured and controlled and contributes to the economy is supported. So it's just one of those things where fundamentally, once you see the connection of like how, when things are measured and controlled and standardized, it takes everything like sacred and beautiful out of it. You can apply that basically to everything. Like I was talking about education with this, you know, it's like standardized tests. Once everybody has to be exactly the same, and it all has to be measured. And incentives are tied to that, to productivity in some way or another. Like, it takes everything interesting and meaningful out of the process of education. Same thing with motherhood. Same thing with agriculture and the domestic sphere. You know, you said this too. It's just like, again, it's pretty illegible. It's hard to make the counter argument because it's nuanced and it's not really measurable in any like formal sense. And a lot of people make the economic counter argument, like, you know, for example, regenerative agriculture requires a lot more people to be involved, to do more hands-on work, and for there to be like an extreme diversity of production methods depending on like specific locality. Same thing is true with education. Same thing is true with parenting. Like, it should be specific to you. You know, it should be something that works within your family culture. It shouldn't be exactly the same for everybody. That's bad. It should be different. but when you set things up like that, it takes all the magic out of it. But it's really hard to describe the counter argument, and people say, like, you know, or that's not efficient, or it's not scalable, or not everybody can do that, or, you know, what is the economic incentive for doing that? I keep thinking back to this thread. I think it was Vox who did, like, the economics behind breastfeeding. And it was,
yeah,
like, it's, oh, remember that? And yeah. I was like, you know, yeah, like, it's just fundamentally, like, against everything I think and feel, which is, like, that, like, the only way to measure anything is, like, the economic cost, you know, it's, yeah, just the economic cost of a pump versus formula, you know, like this kind of thing. It's like, it is so, mm-hmm, it is an infinity more than that. Like you can't even measure how important and impactful breast milk is for babies. Like, it changes throughout their lives for their nutritional needs. It like has antibodies. It's like, I mean, it's like, it's an infinity. It's unmeasurably better.
It literally heals wounds.
Yeah, I mean, it is magic.
Right.
It's literally magic.
It's
crazy. And then, you know, we're just like talking about the cost of a pump versus formula in the midst of a formula crisis, by the way.
Yeah.
We're talking about how breastfeeding's so hard, like, great messaging. I just don't,
yeah,
like, I don't know. And not to say that breastfeeding is super easy. Of course, all of it is more complicated than that. Parenting isn't easy or perfect. It's more complicated. It's a real relationship, but at least you're feeling something real. You're engaged,
yeah,
in something real and productive and meaningful, as opposed to just like the standard consumer treadmill of go to work, commute, purchase things, you know, send your kids off to,
yes,
wherever they need to go, don't see them, and then, you know, come home and post about on Instagram or whatever.
Yeah, I wrote something that the week that came out, or maybe I think it was published like on the same day. And
yes,
I think people might have been like confused because I did write about how difficult it is, but I was writing about how difficult it is precisely because of the system that we've set up. It's difficult,
yep,
because, yep, motherhood is not viewed in any sort of appropriate way. There's no time, no support, no, you know, there are all these things that make it's better. It's better for everybody. Breast is best. I mean, I say this as somebody who ended up having to supplement with formula, because my babies have really intense nutritional needs. And also, like, my nutrition wasn't where it needed to be, and I had a whole host of health problems, and, you know, but, I mean, it's true, like, breast is best, but the only reason why, I don't know, the only reason why, it's not the only reason why it's hard, but we make it harder than it needs to be, is what I'm saying.
Yep. Yeah, and I think this, like, the important thing, like, this goes back to something, you know, how we work in the doomer optimism sphere too, is like, okay, the reason, the movement toward something more meaningful is going to be messy and complicated, and you really need to pull apart seeking this alternative, whatever it is, and is it difficult because it's inherently bad, or is it difficult because the whole system is set up to make you not succeed with it, you know? And I think when it comes to breastfeeding, the perfect example of the latter, like, it's not inherently difficult. It's made more difficult because the whole system is set up against it. Like, I'm pro breastfeeding. I went to La Leche League before I eat, which is like a basically support group for nursing mothers. I went to La Leche League before I even had my first. I was like, I'm doing this. I'm gung ho. I'm breastfeeding. Like, and when my second was born, the doctors made me get the nurses made me give her formula because she's a big baby, which, like, my first one was big. My husband and I were both big. We're both 10 pounds. And she was 10 pounds. And they were like, I'm like, well, does she have any indication of blood sugar issues? No, she doesn't. But since she's big, she has to have the bottle. And I was like, I don't want to give this to her. She doesn't need it. She's fine. There's no medical reason for this. And they were like, if you don't give it to her, we're putting her in the NICU. The intensive care unit for babies. And I was like,
this
is, yeah. And I'm like, you know, so I was so mad, and I ended up, you know, giving her like what, and I was like, is this enough? And I gave her like half the bottle. Like, this is her first, this is the first thing that she's given. When I'm like so pro breastfeeding and there's no medical reason behind it, and I'm trying to advocate for myself, and they're just like threatening me. She ended up going on to breastfeed fine, but like, that kind of thing can cause nipple confusion. A lot of times it can get babies, like, the first thing they latch onto is some, like, you know, rubber nipple. Then they're, like, you know, less confident on the breast. And it's like, you know, there are just so many situations like that where you are fighting against a system that's, like, just, it's just not pro mother and baby and, like, natural methods. It's pro intervention. It's pro doing things that are measured. It's pro, like, especially, don't get me started on, like, childbirth. I mean, it's so, like, it's so determined by liability. You know, a lot of doctors and nurses are just, like, worried about getting sued. So they do all this interventionist stuff just to, like, tick off a box that, like, they tried everything and they made sure to do everything, even when it's not medically necessary. You know, this kind of thing where the whole system is set up to, like, you know, to get you, you know, built, doing things in a way that I think is not pro mother or pro baby or pro, you know, like, natural way of doing things. And so, you know, not to, like, blame mothers for that, but it's just one of those things, like, I'm highly educated on these topics and I was forced to do this thing. You know what I mean? Imagine somebody who's not educated and is just like, you know, afraid and doesn't want their baby to be taken away. And then, you know, okay, well, now the first thing they had was the bottle, and now breastfeeding's hard because they had nipple confusion, and, oh, I'm just going to give up, you know, because of what, you know, right, because some nurse made this decision to cover her ass, you know?
Yeah. And big babies, I mean, they tend to lose, they have more to lose. So they can lose like 10% of a 10 pound baby's body weight is 1 pound. So, I mean, I don't know. That's how much my second lost. She was, you know, she was right back up in a few days. This is normal. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And my first was 10, 12. And
oh my goodness.
I know. And that was
your
the first baby.
First?
I know.
Oh my God. Sorry, I'm sorry.
No drugs. I couldn't even believe it, but I just, like, I had committed in my mind, like, unless I, like, am dying, I'm just gonna do this without drugs. Like, unless I just, like, cannot go on, I'm just gonna try. Cause, like, I read all these horror stories where people, like, got induced or they got epidurals and then the baby's heart rate, like, went down or something, and then they had to do a C-section. And I was like, I don't care what it takes. I don't want a C-section. I don't want abdominal surgery. And so I was just, like, determined. 10, 12, like, insane. But my husband was over 10 pounds as a baby, and I was close to 10. And so I'm like, I know we're going to have big babies. These are our genetics. And in that case, that doctor was very like holistic minded. It was a family practice doctor. And she did not make me give the baby formula. And nobody in that hospital did. So it's like this weird case by case scenario where, you know, you don't know what you're going to get. And you're just like subject to the forces and the whims of like the medical system and whoever you get, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, we are coming up on an hour now, so I want to go ahead and close out and ask you, honestly, I could talk to you all day, but we have to stop at some point. But anyway, I do want to ask, you know, this last piece, which is a great part of my interviews, but for my listeners who may be sort of homesteading, homeschooling, regenerative ag, curious, and just sort of this, you know, more human way of life. Like, how do I approach this or dip a toe? what would your advice be to them? How do you dip a toe into this world? What's the first step?
Yeah, I think that the main thing. When we were talking about breastfeeding, for example, a lot of people think it's either all or nothing. Like they think either I have to like completely breastfeed on demand and have no freedom at all, or I have to go completely formula. I make the suggestion that you can dip a toe in this kind of world without much risk. You know, if you want to try, if you have a baby, for example, and you want to try breastfeeding, try it. If it's like not perfectly great, you can supplement and you can still breastfeed and the baby still gets all of the benefits of having access to breast milk and the nutrition. When it comes to homesteading, like you can plant some fruit trees and you can try keeping chickens. You don't have to like move rural and like have cattle and like live on a farm just to like have any benefits of it. There are ways in which you could buy extra produce from a local apple farm where they wouldn't sell it because it's got like little nicks in it and stuff like that. And you can take that home and turn that into applesauce in your kitchen with your kids. And it's like a fun activity. You go to the place, you meet the farmer, you go home, you make applesauce. Like there are little ways in which you can start to infuse like magic into your lives, you know, like just in little ways. And then what you will find in my experience and when talking to other people who do this is you find like little by little you gain like more confidence to do more, to do different ways. You know, for example, I started out, you know, with my kids and I just like had an interest in homeschooling and now they go to a regular little rural school, but at home we do like different kinds of homeschooling stuff. And increasingly mm-hmm. I've been writing and listening to folk music and we've been like interested in this Charlotte Mason type approach to homeschooling. And it's just like, you know, it's really magical. And you know, I'm gaining competence as both their mother and somebody interested in their education, being engaged in their education. And so I think probably the main hurdle though for a lot of people is to feel like they need to have like some grand plan just to be able to experiment. And they don't. You don't need to have a grand plan. Like just go get a little container, a pot, and plant a potato in it with your kids. Or alone if you have no kids. And like watch a potato sprout. It's like potatoes are grown from other potatoes. So just get a potato at the store, cut it up into a couple of little pieces, and each little, you know, where those little eyes grow out, the little little dots on the potatoes, those will be the roots. So you just cut up, as long as there's like a little dot on the side of potato, that will grow into a plant. Put it in some dirt, see what happens. It's just, you know, it's just fun, it's just magic. And it sounds really silly when I'm just saying go plant a potato, but it like it actually is fine to start with these little experiments where, it, you know, you have a little bit more magic in your life, you know?
That sounds like so much fun. I'm definitely going to do that with my toddler. She will love that. Right yeah. now, she's really enjoying just taking the hose and watering, like spraying it all over the
yes. And so, okay, part of your family routine is like, okay, let's put some water in the dirt. Remember where our potatoes in there? And it's just like one of those things where there's like this magic in the routine of caring for plants, you know, or animals. It's like, you know, just make sure we're doing this thing, and it doesn't have to be like so many. Like a huge garden where you're like so overwhelmed by it. Like it can be a couple plants and you get the gist of it, and it's a good thing for your kid to see, and it's like, and it's fun. And then you go and like harvest it at the end of the season and you're like, oh my God, one potato turned into like 30. Great.
That is such good advice. I love it so much. Ashley, I have had such a good time talking to you. Same. Sorry for crying.
I honestly feel like it's so important to like get these ideas out there, and they're so hard to describe. Like, it is like you really just have to tell people to go experience it. And so it's good to show emotion, I think, about it, because like it's really hard to get across, but it comes across when you like, you know, explain it in depth and with that emotion. I gotta find that Willow tweet too.
And it might not even be her. She might have just been telling me about it.
Okay.
It could have been a situation like that. But, okay. Because she just told me about it. And then, so now I don't know if it was hers or.
One way or another, we need to go find that tweet. It obviously impacted so many people.
We do. Yeah. All right, Ashley. We will talk again soon.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Helen.
Have a good one.